since the 1980s. And this, of course, is the last, and this last one is, of course, as you see, we can't see it there, but it's Child Health Care in Scotland, Overcoming the Challenges to Equality. Now, those of you that attended our conference in 2014, which was all about child-centred or patient-person-centred care for children and young people, recall that it was organised under the auspices of an organisation called Action for Sick Children Scotland. And today, it's Children's Health Scotland. And you may wonder why the name change. Well, there are two main reasons, really. One is to avoid confusion with other charities within Scotland, such as Action for Children, a big charity which covers the whole of the UK, and Action for Sick Children, which although it covers only England, is operational only in England, is sometimes mistakenly thought to cover Scotland as well. And the second reason was that the name no longer properly represented who we are and what we do. Many of the children that we work with, children with long-term disorders and disabled children or looked after children, don't recognise themselves as being sick. So a name change seemed appropriate on those grounds. Now, we may have changed our name, but what we stand for hasn't changed. Children's Health Scotland is the only charity in Scotland dedicated to representing, promoting and safeguarding the child health rights, the child care rights of children and the needs of all children and young people. And we do this by campaigning, delivering effective projects, being involved with Scottish Government in developing policy and in working groups, and providing practical support for families and children. Now, our vision is the best quality care for children and young people in Scotland. Our mission is to enable every child to be able to exercise these rights. And I emphasise the word every, not some, not most, but every child. The rights to health and healthcare are enshrined in UNCRC Article 24, which states that states parties recognise the right of the child to the enjoyment of the highest attainable standard of health and to facilities for the treatment of illness and rehabilitation of health. States parties shall strive to ensure that no child is deprived of his or her right of access to such healthcare services. It goes on to say, states parties shall pursue full implementation of the right and in particular shall take appropriate measures to diminish infant and child mortality. Now, inequality of healthcare is inextricably linked to inequality of health. And denial of a child's right to quality of healthcare is, in part at least, a denial of the right to quality of health. And poverty, economic, social, and educational has long been known as a barrier to both. In The Wealth of Nations, 1776, Adam Smith wrote, "But poverty, though it does not prevent the generation, is extremely unfavourable to the rearing of children. It is not uncommon, I've been frequently told, in the Highlands of Scotland, for a mother who has borne 20 children not to have but two alive. This great mortality, however, will everywhere be found chiefly among the children of the common people who cannot afford to tend them with the same care as those of a better station." Fast forward to the 19th century, when infant mortality was running well in excess of 100 per 1,000 live births. That's 100 deaths per 1,000 live births in the first year of life. And the first annual report of the Registrar General in 1861 contained the statistic that 32% of all deaths in children under the age of five in Glasgow, and deaths under the age of five were the highest rate of mortality throughout life at that time, 32% of deaths in children under five in Glasgow were amongst those born living in what were called single ends, that's to say, one-room homes, whereas only 2% were born or lived at home in homes with five bedrooms or more. Now, the inception of the NHS in 1948 was supposed to put an end to poverty being a barrier to quality of healthcare. But as Sir Douglas Black noted in his report in 1980, though infant and child mortality had markedly diminished by the 1960s and 70s, health inequalities had, if anything, widened rather than diminished. Infant death, for example, between 1 month and 1 year, the postneonatal mortality, was four to five times higher in social class five, that was the registrar general's classification at the time, that means unskilled manual, four to five times higher than it was in social class one, the professional classes. Black doesn't use the term equality or inequality of healthcare, but he does refer to the inequalities of utilisation of health services, particularly the preventative services such as antenatal care and immunisation. And he attributes the severe underutilisation of health services by lower-income families to underprovision in socially deprived areas and to costs, financial and psychological, and costs here refers to the cost of a worker taking time off from his work. Black recommended a wide strategy of social policy measures in order to combat inequalities in health, the first of which was to give children a better start in life. Unfortunately, the findings and recommendations were virtually ignored by the Secretary of State for Social Services in Margaret Thatcher's first government, the Edinburgh-born Patrick Jenkin. Nevertheless, by the mid-1990s, infant mortality was down to 6 per 1,000 live births, and the odds of infant mortality in the most deprived versus the least deprived was down to 1.7. That's to say, there was only a 70% greater risk of death in the first year of life, which is roughly where it's persisted until today. I say only because that's a big improvement compared to the 1,600% increased risk of death in those living in this or born in the single ends in the 1860s. Now, there's a wealth of evidence to show that the foundations of adult health are laid in childhood. It should therefore come as no surprise to learn that the effects of socioeconomic deprivation in early life are seen in adult life, so that, for example, healthy life expectancy, or otherwise termed disability-free life expectancy, for 2013 to 2014, in the most deprived areas of Scotland, was 25 years less in males and 22 years less in females compared to those in the least deprived areas. So there's clearly quite a lot of work still to do. Now, it's a moot point to question how far health policy can mitigate the impact of socioeconomic deprivation on quality of access to healthcare in this era of, I put it extended, but you might say eternal austerity. However, there is one area of healthcare provision I should like to pick up on which could be fixed if there was a will, and that is the geographical variation of provision of healthcare services. It remains a problem 37 years after Black first identified it in his report. Now, in relation to the quality of healthcare provision for children and young people, it isn't just a question of whether, for example, there is accessible primary care in a particular area, deprived or otherwise. It's also a question of whether the professionals in that primary care setting have the relevant knowledge and skill set to provide the necessary care that children and young people deserve. It may not be widely known, but roughly half the GPs in practice have no more than a few weeks undergraduate training and none at postgraduate level. Now, campaign for the rights of parents and carers to know which GP practices in their area have at least one doctor with at least 6 months postgraduate training has fallen on deaf ears, so it remains a lottery. Even our suggestion that GP practices should identify on their websites or wherever which of their staff has some postgraduate training has met with resistance on the grounds that either the individual doctors would be overwhelmed by so many families with children coming to see them, or those practices with no one with postgraduate training might be shunned, or even, would you believe it, that it would be boring for the individual doctor if he were to be restricted to one particular specialism. Since we failed thus far spectacularly in this campaign, perhaps the CMO would like to pick this up and run with it. I'm very much looking forward to today's programme of talks and hope that policy initiatives will be accompanied by reference to outcomes and monitoring of outcomes, without which we've got no idea whether the initiatives that we take are effective or not. To quote from the evaluation of the development and early implementation phases of GERFEC carried out in Highland, the effectiveness of integrated working needs to be measured in terms of the outcomes for the child and young person, rather than in terms of whether or not the specific service outputs were delivered. I don't think one can improve on that. One last word before I hand over to Steve Turner to give the conference get the conference programme underway. This conference is not about you, the audience, being lectured to. It's about a discussion, if you like. To be a success, it needs questions and comments from you, and I hope you'll keep those coming as we go through the day. So that's about enough from me. Steve Turner, who is your chair for the day, will be known to many of you already. He's a consultant paediatrician and senior lecturer in child health in Aberdeen, with a personal chair in child health and well-being. Steve is an active researcher in children's respiratory disease, particularly asthma, and has published widely on the subject, and 2016, for his sins, he's been Scottish officer for the Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health. So over to you, Steve.
Ladies and gentlemen, good morning. Thank you very much for the welcome, and great to see you all here. This room is a grand and glorious room, and many of you will be sitting here thinking, what a splendid room. But about 17 years ago, I sat doing an exam where that lady in the red top is sitting. So this room always gives me that extra bit of adrenaline. But it's great to be here. You're all very welcome. I'm going to be short and brief. A bit of a safety brief. I am informed there's no fire alarm practice today, so if the bells do ring, you'll have seen where the exits are. Can you put your mobiles on silent, please, if they're not already? The new thing in the safety brief these days is please tweet, whatever that is. So please tweet. And I guess my final comment to you all is there's no such thing as a free lunch. I would challenge you all to pick up one fact from today, and just one is all you need. Two would be fine, three would be far too clever, okay? But take something back to your constituency. Make this day different to what you do next week, because otherwise, to be honest, there's not a lot of point of being here. This has got to be a meeting that changes practice, and I'm very keen that you all do that. So, you've all seen the programme. You'll be aware that the Minister isn't able to come today. So Catherine Coldwood is going to give a single presentation that's going to pick up from where Richard left off talking about inequalities, and then he's going to talk about realistic medicine. We plan to finish, as scheduled, at about 10:30 for some questions. Please write down some questions. People, I'm going to keep you on your toes today. It's really nice. Even the front row is full. What a great audience. I'm looking forward to a great day. So, without any ado, I'd like to invite Catherine to come up and talk. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Steve, and thank you for the kind invitation to speak. I have been in this room many times as well, none of them quite with the adrenaline of sitting a professional exam, Steve, but I'm absolutely delighted to be here. This is my 70th talk this year so far, and I only get to do about a third of the invitations that I'm invited to speak at. And so it's because I thought that this was such an important event and such an important charity and one of Scottish Government's partners that I'm really pleased to have been able to accept and be with you today. So I would echo Steve's comments about questions for later. I love speaking to audiences and getting their feedback, and I always take something away that then appears in the next talk. Bill, do I just go? Yeah, here we go, right. There we are. And can I just go? Oh, yes. So important thing for me to say, as well as being the first female chief medical officer in Scotland, I'm also the only chief medical officer ever to still see patients. And so that word obstetrician on the slide is very important to me. I get to my antenatal clinic when I can, and I will tell you a story from that a little bit later. So as I've mentioned already, Children's Health Scotland are an important partner with government, and I also need to congratulate you on being one of the six nominees for the Lothian Self-Management Project Prize for supporting children and young people with long-term conditions. I also congratulate you on the change of the name. And I think that we, in the same way that my pregnant women don't think of themselves as patients, children who are in all of the areas you work in don't usually think of themselves as sick. So your ethos has not changed, but your name change, I think, is a very good thing. Cincinnati's Children's Hospital has the strapline, "Until every child is well." And I'm not absolutely sure that's what is realistic to be aiming for. So I'm going to talk to you a little bit about realistic medicine. Chief medical officers have to write an annual report every year. We write that with a lot of data, the health of the nation in Scotland. But what I did was something a little bit different. And I'm going to talk to you about how the response to practicing what has now become known across the world as realistic medicine really fits into what all of you are doing. So I talked to the doctors of Scotland about personalised care and changing our style to shared decision making. And of course, that's what all of us would want for ourselves. Some of this was come about because I was hearing from doctors that they were practicing medicine that they didn't want to practice, that they were over-medicalizing, and that they were not able to have time to talk to people about what their priorities were. At that same time, I found some research that said that doctors actually choose less treatment for themselves than they would give to their patients. I didn't really understand that. So I've done a bit of exploring, and it would turn out that actually most of us would want what we think to be the most important things in our lives to be taken into account in whatever aspect of the system we're in, be that healthcare, be that social care, be that in all of the different parts of the system that you're working in. So we really wanted to talk today about some of our inequalities in Scotland and how we're managing to tackle those. A little bit about Scotland. There are about 5.2 million people in Scotland. It's 8% of the UK population and around 30% of the UK land mass. There are 1 million children in Scotland, a fifth of our population, and around 60,000 babies are born every year. There's a £13 billion budget for health, and that's a third of all the money that we get from the Westminster government. A third of it is for health, and what I feel awkward in government rooms is because that health fund is ring-fenced. So when my colleagues who are in charge of roads or education or housing are looking for more money, I have to sit very quietly and look at the floor because I know that they aren't getting as much money because my money is protected. Now, I know it doesn't feel like that, but I think it's important that we realise that. The pot is not finite. So about £3.66 billion is for education. As I say, I looked down at the floor when we talked to our education colleagues about needing more money. And there are 14 health boards in Scotland, and it's not a coincidence that these are 14 different tartans, because we find differences in practice, as Professor Ollier's already mentioned, differences in practices and differences in outcomes across our very small country, across those 14 different health boards. We have 8 support boards, so that's NHS Education for Scotland, National Services Scotland, which does all the buildings and the procurement for Scotland, and our Healthcare Improvement Scotland, amongst others. So why is it important that an obstetrician is talking to you? Because we all start over on that side of the top left of the slide, and hopefully end up at the bottom right. And part of my job as an obstetrician is to ensure that that journey is safe and that that mum and that baby at the end of the pregnancy are well. Many of you, though, may have seen the recent research in the importance of that 9 months while the baby is growing and developing. And this article in Time magazine several years ago described how the first 9 months shape the rest of your life. Because we now know that the origins of all of these diseases start in the womb. So a mum with a BMI of 50 while she is pregnant, the RNA in that baby adapts adversely in that unhealthy environment, and that child has 5 times risk of cardiovascular disease than a baby born to a mum with a normal BMI. So when I talk to rooms of people like yourselves, rooms of obstetricians like me, what I say, and this is true, that we hold the future health of the nation in our hands. Because if we don't keep our young people healthy that go on to become parents, and we don't keep our children healthy, we are storing up more and more of all of these diseases for the future. Human brain development, this is from Harvard, from the Center on the Developing Child, being very active in producing a lot of research on human brain development. So you'll see that, of course, everything starts before birth, and look at the number of neuronal connections and pathways that develop in that first year of life, so that children have all of the neuronal connections for language, vision, and hearing before the majority of them have connected before they are 1 year old. You can see that their higher cognitive function potential continues until around the age of 6, and then after that, all of these go downwards. So we have real opportunities very early in life, no matter what a child's circumstances, to change these connections, this brain development. The brain is very plastic. And with good experience, all of these connections continue to be made, and we can overcome some of the adverse conditions that children may be born in. So you may or may not know that 80% of our spend in the NHS is in the last 2 years of a person's life. It will not surprise you to hear when I think 80% of the spend on our health and future should be. So why is this early years and the pregnant woman and the early child development so important? As I've already said, we store up problems for the future. So this is a study looking at pregnant women at 32 weeks and asking them about their anxiety levels. The anxiety levels in those women correlate with the problems of child mental health in their children. So those bars represent the percentage of children with mental health problems. The mums with low prenatal anxiety are in the black columns. Those with high are in the white columns. And as you can see, right through as that child grows up, there's a connection between women with higher anxiety in pregnancy and those mental health problems in their children. This then is another study asking women about depression in pregnancy. What I really think is very compelling about this is that sentence at the top. So if women were not depressed in pregnancy, their children did not show signs of depression all the way through childhood. But children who were depressed all had mothers who had had depressive illness, mostly during pregnancy. And as you can see, that time when it's most at risk is when the women are depressed when they are pregnant. But it also continues into those early years after the baby is born. So when I've told you all of that, I know that you're going to think, gosh, well, we must really make a big effort to look after women when they're pregnant and diagnose and treat their depression. And when their babies are first born, we must make sure we diagnose and treat them then. So postnatal depression, the most common type of depression, it's in fact the most common complication in pregnancy. 12% of women have postnatal depression. It's much more common than preeclampsia and thromboembolism, clots in the leg or the lungs, which we spend a lot of time and effort on. So if we take the prevalence of postnatal depression as 100%, so how many people have it, around 12%, as I say, of pregnant women, only 40% is picked up clinically. When we do pick it up, we treat 24%. Most of those are not treated adequately, and only 3% of women achieve remission. Now, if I was talking to you about a population who had appendicitis, rheumatology diseases, diabetes, I don't think our rates of pickup, diagnosis, treatment would be like that, would they? So where is the disconnect between what I've told you about how important maternal mental health is and how we're actually diagnosing and treating it? I'll leave you to think about some of the reasons that that might be. And some of them might lead back to importance of women in our society, but that's a different talk. So I have some good news. Life expectancy at birth in Scotland is rising. It's risen year on year over the last 20, 30, 40 years. And for those of us in the audience who are women, for once the women are on top, as it has always been. However, not so good is that that life expectancy increase is reducing in rate. So we're no longer really getting healthier and healthier and living longer as fast as we were. And there are many theories for that. That's another talk again. One of those theories might be because of current austerity. So we need to be very aware of this, because we've made really good progress with people living longer, healthier lives, but that appears to be slowing down. What about children, which is really what I'm here to talk about? So what might harm our children other than, of course, before they're even born, or in those very early years when I've already talked about their mother's mental health status? So our children in Scotland are becoming more obese, as are the adults in Scotland. But what these next few slides show is that they're becoming more obese more rapidly in our deprived communities than in our more affluent communities. And you'll see that those health inequalities, so overall there's a slow decline in the obesity in children. These are children in primary one. So the green line is Scotland overall. And you'll see that it's stabilised or perhaps falling a little. What you'll see, though, is that that's because of the blue line, which is our most affluent children, who are much less obese, and that obesity rate is falling very rapidly. However, if you look at the red line, you'll see that in our most deprived communities, not only are children, the obesity rate not stabilising, it's actually increasing. So the fall, which looks very good and nice, that green line, is because of affluent children. So when I'm talking about these statistics, what I'd like you to do is to think about these statistics and children in the most deprived communities as people. Can you picture, wherever you are from in Scotland, the most deprived part of near where you live? Most of us don't live in the most deprived communities. Some of us do, but most of us don't. Can you imagine your local high street or your local area where you don't really tend to go, where you don't choose to shop? Have you wandered along and seen how many betting shops there are? How many takeaways? How many of those rather grotty looking news agents that purport to sell food? There's nothing fresh in any of those. You will find 20 different types of fizzy drink, though, and probably some frozen pizza. But if you wanted to buy an apple, not only would it cost you more than a packet of crisps, but it might not actually be available. Do we think about, when we talk about our most deprived communities, what it must actually feel like to live there? To need to get two buses to somewhere to buy some proper food that doesn't cost three times as much because it's from the local shop? Do we know what it's like to live and grow up somewhere where 30% of the people around you are smoking? Where there are people who have been put in jail? Where there are people without enough to eat? Where 6% in some of our Scottish communities of children suffer holiday hunger? That means that when they're not at school, they don't have enough to eat because there isn't enough food at home. and they're relying on their school lunch as the food they're eating in the day. So I know I'm talking lots of facts and figures, but these are children. Children like my children. Children like your children or your nieces and nephews. These aren't statistics. These are people. So our inequalities across Scotland are geographical. This is a map of childhood obesity, which ranges from 20% in the light blue and 27% in the dark blue. And it may surprise you that perhaps which are the areas with the most obese children. It's not perhaps where you were all thinking, is it? It's actually Dumfries and Galloway and Orkney and Shetland. Are these children normal weight? Hands up. Too skinny. Normal weight? So these are children from the 1950s, and you're right. That's what a child with a normal BMI looks like. So have we reset our normality? Do we even notice what's going on around us? You were very good. The last audience all thought they were too skinny. So what else might harm children? I've already alluded to it, so I won't repeat it, but these are our smoking statistics. We're aiming for a smoke-free Scotland, by 2034. That means less than 5%. We're probably on that trajectory, but you can see that it's once again very different whether you're from one of those communities I've been describing to you or whether you're from a more affluent area. So 30-plus percent of people in most deprived communities, and that includes our pregnant women. So 20% of pregnant women in Scotland smoke in our most deprived communities, and it's less than 5% of the most wealthy. So again, this is just dividing by the Scottish household survey data, divided again by deprivation, and you'll see that once again, the inequalities exist with our most deprived communities. What about teeth? Our dentists would tell us that the mouth is a vision of the health of the rest of the body. So when we started our Child Smile campaign, this is an old slide to show you the baseline, we aimed to have children registering with a dentist and the amazing rocket science intervention of encouraging them to brush their teeth every day. And this is where we were starting from. So children in our most deprived communities, only 42% of them were registered with a dentist. And we now, of course, have not only reached our aims for children registering with a dentist, but we've very much exceeded them. And we now have 85 to 95% of all children across Scotland registered with a dentist and cleaning their teeth every day. And of course, my dental colleagues would tell you about the massive difference that that makes right the way through a child's life. So perhaps you've heard enough to make you think, what are the consequences for some children of living in the way that I've described? There's quite a lot of interest at the moment in adverse childhood experiences because we have found that these actually have a lifelong effect on children. So adverse childhood experiences are described, as you can see, abuse, be that physical or emotional or sexual, neglect, physical or emotional, and household dysfunction. So mental illness, mother treated violently, divorce and separation, substance abuse, and an incarcerated relative, and some of what I've been describing today is where these children are living. Probably more common than you think. So the most comprehensive study is in Wales. You'll see there that when they looked at children being maltreated, those statistics of 23% subjected to verbal abuse and 17% to physical abuse. And then when they asked adults in Wales about their circumstances, 47% had at least one adverse childhood experience as defined, as I've defined for you. But what we know is that though the child may forget, the child's body does not forget. So what we now know is that people who've suffered four or more adverse childhood experiences, and I'm just giving you a snapshot of some of the harms that those cause. Four times more likely to be a high-risk drinker, six times more likely to be a smoker, and 16 times more likely to be a serious drug addict. What about mental health? Four times increased risk of depression, six times risk of not actually just feeling good at all, and 12 times risk of attempting suicide. Physical health is also affected. Three times increased risk of heart disease, three times increased risk of respiratory disease, and a three times risk of diabetes. And I have other slides which show harms in other areas of children's and subsequently adults' lives. So again, you might say, if all of this is so important, what are we doing? Because we're storing up problems for our children, who of course are our future. So I alluded to my report, Realistic Medicine, when I started my talk. We asked the questions because we were not sure that what we were doing was the right thing to do for people. And the response to that report has been overwhelming. The response to that report has been, we stopped counting actually at 15 million hits on Twitter. And I would encourage you, although Steve isn't on Twitter, to get onto Twitter and tweet about the conference, but also to join us in the realistic medicine conversation. So what has happened is we have really started to talk about a much more personalised approach to care. So I said I was going to tell you about one of my pregnant ladies. So she's called Jenny. And I had met her in a previous pregnancy, but on this occasion, she was coming to see me for a scan. She was on her 9th pregnancy. She was 24. She was having an extra scan or several scans because her previous baby had been stillborn. Previous baby had been stillborn because the baby hadn't grown. She was a smoker. She was an occasional drug user. As I say, she had, at that time, 7 other children. And when I saw her this time, I said, oh, how are you? Because I recognized her. And the chap with her, I didn't recognize. I said, well, what's that? Where's Stephen? She said, I don't really want to talk about it, doctor. I said, well, where? He's in the jail. I said, oh, okay. I don't want to talk about it. GBH. Okay, and so who's this? Oh, this is Jamie. Okay, hello, Jamie. We don't live together, though. Jamie's got his own children, but he's here to see the scan. So with her, she had brought her 2 youngest children. They were probably 1 and 3, and my children at that time were roughly the same. And the scan room is dark and it's hot, and the children were fidgeting, and she got them up on the table and back down. And I eventually said, Jamie, do you want to take the children to the waiting room? There are some toys and maybe. Nah, they want to see the telly, which was the scan. I said, well, it's not a great telly program. Why don't you, oh, okay, I'll take them out. And I could tell that really what they needed was probably a drink of milk and a sleep. So I was quite pleased when he took one of those plastic cups, you know, the ones with a lid that doesn't spill. I thought, oh, great. So he took it up, but there was nothing in it. So he went out, and a few minutes later he came back. He didn't take the children with him. He came back in. And he had a bottle of Coke from the vending machine. And he opened the Coke, full sugar Coke, and he poured it into the cup. And he offered it to the little baby, about 1, 1 and a half, and the baby wouldn't drink it. Kicking and screaming, you know what they're like if you've got children. And Jenny said, it's okay, Jamie, there's a poke of sugar in my handbag. And she reached into her bag and lifted out a Tesco plastic bag, and in the corner, in a twist, there was some sugar. And she untwisted the bag, she opened the tippy cup, she poured the sugar in, and the baby drank it. And I know that you know that the reason for doing that is that if you pour sugar into fizzy drink, it goes flat. So I wonder what experiences those children were growing up with. And actually, I really thought, do you know what? She doesn't need medicine at all, does Jenny? doesn't need me. So what have we done in Scotland? What have we done in Scottish Government to take on some of these really very challenging situations and also to tackle these very challenging inequalities? So maybe we can discuss later, but I suppose you might start in my world, which would be with the introduction of baby boxes, a universal gift from Scottish Government, which has clothes and toys and books and a changing mat, and there's one in my office and it's really cute, for every child born after the 15th of August of this year. It also is a safe place to sleep, and you'll know that one of the big risk factors for cot death is sleeping in a bed or a sofa with a parent. And so every child in Scotland now has a safe place to sleep. The box is accredited as a cot, the same as you would buy from a furniture store, and it has a new mattress in it and a cellular blanket. And we'll evaluate whether it changes our cot death rate in Scotland, whether it changes the way parents and where they put their children to sleep. So that's one from my world. We have also a child poverty bill, which is enabling us to give every child in Scotland the best start in life. That best start report that we did on the maternity and neonatal services that we provide for our children across Scotland. And of course, many of you know of our investment in more health visitors and our recent announcement of the rollout of the Family Nurse Partnership for teenage pregnant women across Scotland. And that's being rolled out now to all parts of Scotland. So we do realise that there's work to be done. I've talked about the adverse childhood experiences and in our Scottish Government programme for government that laid out what the government will do for 17-18, we have a commitment to raise awareness of adverse childhood experiences and to work with our partners to perhaps introduce routine inquiry about these adverse experiences into all of the work that I'm doing, that people in this room are doing. Our mental health strategy has committed more money to mental health. We are wanting to aim for more equity between mental and physical health, and that has not been the case so far. There is a lot of work to be done. And I think mental health problems, mental health issues, and you've seen my figures, have really been neglected. And we need to change that. Because you can see, arguably, looking after those pregnant women's mental health properly is as good, if not more impactful, on the baby's outcome as well as the mother's than some of the physical things that we traditionally concentrate on. So we're the only country in the world to have a target for child and adolescent mental health services. We know we don't meet it, and that's why the mental health strategy has injected some more money, particularly into that area. And there's also a particular focus, and you might want to think who might have influenced that, on our perinatal mental health services, specifically mentioned in the strategy as needing to become more of a priority. I think we are recognising that what we have done up to this point has not necessarily been enough. Has it been focused in the right areas? And you'll also know about the Best Start grant, which is from May 2017, has rolled the Healthy Start voucher scheme into this Best Start grant to try to improve the health and nutrition of our children. Again, I've shown you those figures. I've shown you those inequalities. And what about a healthier future? And I would encourage all of you, all of your organisations, to contribute to our diet and obesity strategy consultation. It was launched week before last. It's quite a different consultation document. It's laid out quite differently if you've not seen it. And it's actually a document that we really want to hear from the people of Scotland about. We want to be really very bold. I have vibes from the Westminster government that because they had a rather watered-down version earlier in the year, they're rather miffed that Scotland is doing something really quite bold along the lines that they wanted to. And probably more powerfully than anything we could do, Jamie Oliver has endorsed it and has tweeted a picture of himself holding a saltire, and he thinks we're marvellous. So ironically, all the government campaigning in the world probably doesn't have as much effect as Jamie Oliver standing with a psalter. So I think we really know what we need to do. You in this room are working all the time, wherever you are. I've asked you to walk yourselves through your own communities. I've talked a little bit about realistic medicine. I think what we need to do is to stop talking about people being sick, people being patients. People are people, children are children. The part of their lives that they are in our services or in our care or working with us is a small minority of the time that they are spent living with their parents, whoever they may be and whatever their circumstances, living in those communities that I've described to you. And from what I've said, I hope you realize that there is plenty we can do to change our outcomes for our children in Scotland, to change the outcomes for that baby that I was describing to you, Jenny's 9th pregnancy, 8th baby. There's plenty more we can do. It's not a case of saying it's always been like this. It's too difficult. We don't know what to do. And in case any of you are thinking that there's a room full of leaders in Scotland who are going to take all of this forward, I'm going to disappoint you, because you are the room full of leaders. There aren't other people, if you look over your shoulder, who are going to take these challenges and move forward with them. I'm afraid the leaders are you. So I really hope you enjoy your day. I really hope to be invited back to give you some more encouraging statistics, but I won't be able to do any of that without your help. Thank you very much.
Excuse me, Chairman. Can you press the mic, please?
Ah, the red button means it's on. My voice usually travels very well. Thank you very much. We go there, not because it's easy, because it's hard. The second thing that he said, which I don't think he actually said, but is attributed to, is that all boats are lifted on a rising tide. And when people look at child health, they often say, well, what do we do? What's the most important thing? And the answer to that is there's no one important thing. What we know is that the sum of individual interventions, smoking, alcohol, maternity services, ACEs, is much greater than the individual parts, so it's everything. We've now got 15 minutes between us and coffee. We've got Catherine here. I think you're planning to leave at about 11. So this is a perfect opportunity to speak directly to the Scottish Government. If I can just sort of set the scene, I think it's fantastic that Scottish Government is now realising that the early origins of health are laid in an early days. As an obstetrician, you're always going to be saying it's the first 9 months, but obviously I think the first 1,000 days are particularly important. And in many ways, birth, I've not actually obviously delivered. I've been delivered. I don't remember it particularly well. But birth is a fairly incidental pathway on our trajectory from conception through to full development. I think adolescence, particularly in the context of mental health and well-being, is another very critical point. But I think if we get the first 1,000 days right, we're probably setting off on a good start. So how do we change this, people? I think Catherine has challenged us to push forward. Does anybody have any particular comments? Elaine.
Good morning. Thank you very much for that presentation.
Do you want to just introduce yourself?
Yes, I'm Elaine Lockhart. I'm a child and adolescent psychiatrist in Glasgow. So what you're speaking about is really heartening to hear. And I thought it would be good to share with the audience something and also then make a plea to the highest level of the Scottish Government about language. As you mentioned, the perinatal mental health is part of the mental health strategy. And there's an infant mental health component to that, with Dr. Anne McFadgen taking a lead in that. And the people from that work will be visiting all health boards. And at the moment, we have very little in terms of services for infant mental health. I have to say, within CAMHS, we don't really do it because we're overwhelmed with crises in older children and young people. So it's a real opportunity for us all to come together and think, how can we intervene as early as possible? And the second thing was about using the term mental health problems. And I think if adults get mental illness, so do children and young people. And I think that that term is used a lot when we're talking about under 18s. And we need to recognise that at least 10% of children and young people have mental illness. And it's very hard to argue for funding if we're not clear what it is we're looking to help. So thanks.
Did you have any particular comments? I think you weren't asking any particular questions. I mean, I think there's going to be a lot of discussion about mental health and well-being. I think it's an important dichotomy there, that there's mental illness, but there's also a much more difficult to measure amount of anxiety, etc. And I think you touched on that when you were talking about maternal mental health. How do you measure something as private and poorly recognised as mental health? One of our many challenges. We talked a lot about obesity. Does anybody have any points back?
It's kind of from a personal point of view. My daughter has actually just started primary school this year, so obviously there was a lot about childhood obesity in there. Why does she get a dessert every day for lunch? I know that's maybe not a question for you to answer, but it generally just kind of genuinely popped into my head there while you were speaking. I've never really kind of thought about it.
I think that's a brilliant question. I was invited to the people who provide all of the school meals for all of our schools across Scotland, so their annual conference. I'm not absolutely sure they were completely delighted with the message I gave them, because one, I was really shocked because I gave them some of those statistics. I showed them that skinny children picture, and it was as if I was speaking to people who had never thought of it at all. I did a pretty hard hitting, much more, it was only obesity. And the whole room was absolutely, oh my goodness, we did not realize. And they actually, I challenged them with the exact thing. I said, why does my son, he get on a Friday, there's a special Friday, and it's pizza and chips. Maybe we could just ditch the chips. And they, to be fair, they took it on board. They did a whole range of workshops and went out to their, I suppose it's their clients, the children. And looked at what children really wanted to eat. So there's a whole range of, they've got a campaign called Inch by Inch, which is encouraging children to eat more healthily. It was launched a couple of months ago. There is a website. And they've tried to introduce sort of street food, so healthy food, not just the traditional stuff, but healthy food that children want to eat. They have physical activity built in. The children can invent meals, and they get prizes, and there's a whole star system with rewards. It's good. I suppose, also really implying to them that some of this was their responsibility, and they didn't really like that. But they have taken that on board. They have really said, it obviously hasn't gone everywhere if your daughter has a dessert every day. But they are really working on it. I think the other thing is that we need as a community to ask the questions. I know a colleague of mine at work, his child was getting chocolate milk, and he wrote in and said, why are you getting chocolate milk? That's not. And they went, oh yeah, fair enough, good point, and stopped it. So some of it is just not people even thinking about it. So I think your question is really good, and I actually think each of us, if just as a parent, or we can actually influence some of that, because some of it is just asking the questions.
So that's your action for next week. No. Easy. You can switch off for the rest of the day. There's a question at the front here, and then one at the back. One, two.
Hi, I'm Alison Rennie. I'm a consultant paediatrician and clinical director in the NHS Greater Glasgow and Clyde, and I work in community paediatrics. So again, I am still a jobbing paediatrician, and firsthand, every week we see the effects of poverty and austerity, and I see how people are living in our communities, particularly groups like asylum seekers. I think our families are finding it really challenging in this day and age, and when we are looking to try and get support services, we're struggling sometimes to identify where we can get those from. And although I'm pleased to see how the statistics in Scotland are generally improving year on year, I do worry that we're storing up problems for the future, because I see the effects of mental health difficulties both in our children, but also in the parents that are caring for them. And we're seeing more and more children with autism, particularly very challenging behaviour within autism. Parents are getting older, struggling to cope with boys who get bigger and more aggressive. And I do wonder where the supports are going to come from in this day and age.
And some of that is the recognition. So I'm giving statistics that you may know, but that generally are not known. And I think that the current government's ambition to reduce these inequalities is borne out in some of these policies. Some of the problem is recognising there's a problem and how big that is. There's more to be done, absolutely. But the recognition of the issues, I think, is a good start.
Question at the back.
Good morning. I'm Adam Smith, and I'm an improvement advisor at Scottish Government. And I was just reflecting back on the story that you told about Jenny. And Catherine, you were saying about a child, 1 year old, and you saw something that wasn't right. And we talk all the time about early intervention and prevention. And do you feel there was a vision, or is there a protocol in place for you to have intervened? So what happened to that child when you noticed something wasn't right there? Did the family just leave the appointment and nothing was done? Or I would like to know what happened next for that child.
So somebody asked me recently, was I different since I had become CMO when I'm in my clinic? And the answer to that is very much yes. So I think a lot, not all, but a lot of doctors treat the problem in front of them, the clot in the leg, in my case, the preeclampsia in the pregnant woman, and actually some of those other issues that arguably are equally important are not our job. Now, that's not every doctor, of course. I know that what we do have good systems in place for flagging children at risk, and that really is what you're getting at. So when you see something like that, that's what I would have done. Go to the notes, have they already been identified? And if not, speak to the midwife. There are usually people who have a special interest in and knowledge of what then would be the services that would be provided. But I think the point you're making is, do we actually do that? And do people who are seeing problems instigate some of this help? I think my answer might be not always, but that's not the practitioner's fault. I don't think we make these things available easily. I don't think that we make it easier for somebody in a busy clinic who's looking after the woman with the clot in her leg, even in my clinic, for me to refer somebody to help stop smoking. It takes time and effort, and actually what we've now done is that the smoking cessation midwife is in the clinic, so it's easy. So that's the sort of change we need to make to services. I don't think we should blame doctors, nurses, midwives for not getting involved in what is actually very complex and time consuming, But what we need to do is make it easy for them to flag a problem and for the problem to be then, the person being helped is easy. And do we have people thinking that that is really their job? I think that's another part of the system.
Thank you.
To tackle.
Okay. I mean, I guess more health visitors and the family nurse partnership will go some way to doing this. We've got one question here, if we can keep it short, and then another one here before.
It's not actually a question. I'm Anne Mullen, I'm a GP in Govan, and I just wanted to make a plea, really, that I think when public health initiatives come out that are seen at a very high level as a national public health policy, that it does somehow link into general, I'm going to speak shamelessly about general practice because I'm a GP, but it does link into general practice because we are the professions that have population coverage and continuity. We're very unique in that way. We're here to talk about child health, but a lot of what we talk about is actually parental health. And that is just my comment. But thank you, that was a very interesting talk.
And I think that is where the primary care services are embedded in these communities that I'm talking about. I mean, of anybody, you're there knowing what the lived experience is.
One question. Oh, sorry. Sorry. So one question here, one question there, and then we'll adjourn.
You first.
Please, yes.
Good morning, my name is Marina Madden. I'm a service manager in the East End of Glasgow and I manage the universal services including Family Nurse Partnership. Posed for me, my question looking at equality is in relation to the baby boxes and the universal offer. And one of the things that we're identifying in a particularly vulnerable area is that whilst it's a universal offer, we're not always getting a universal uptake in some of the area, and the ladies who are in the most deprived areas see it almost as a stigma that they're getting something free and they're taking it as an indication that perhaps they can't afford it. And I wonder if government had actually built in that we actually monitor this in some ways so that we're not indirectly creating a greater inequality.
And that's an interesting point. The points that have been made to me is, why was it universal? And I make the reverse point, which is because if it wasn't universal, it would be stigmatising. But you're saying even though it's universal, it's potentially people are feeling it's stigmatising or it's not something they want to have.
I think it's culture.
Culture, okay.
So I guess the take-home point both of you, you put this on your piece of paper and then you can switch off, is to look at how uptake differs by different communities or socioeconomic
stages. I'll ask that question. Right? I know we're looking at uptake, but I don't know whether we're looking at it in it with any breakdown of who's not taking them. So I'll ask the question.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. And thank you for your patience at the back.
It's okay. I'll just stand because I'm small. I'm Carrie-Anne Logan and I'm a social worker. Just now I work for Family Addiction Support Services and my kind of interest is about the ACEs and obviously raising awareness of ACEs in children that you see. Now we know they've got GIRFEC, getting it right for every child, and we've got that policy, and it's about sharing information and raising those with the right kind of authorities. So it's those universal supports and health supports that we look to, like schools, GPs and things like that. But what I just wonder how we make it easier for GPs especially to attend meetings about children, especially whether it when it becomes maybe a child protection issue, because I know from my background in social work that a lot of GP physicians do not necessarily attend these meetings, and I think it's really important that how do we make it better and how do we share more information from the GP side of it so they can get GPs and physicians to attend. It might normally be the health visitor, but I'm just wondering how can we then make things better, because I know that a lot of GPs don't attend. Can, and I understand busy caseloads, we've all got busy workloads, but I just wondered, you know, for me that's a barrier, and I'm just thinking we need to raise it and it needs to be better, because we need to do better for our children. So.
And I think you're making a very good point. I don't know whether you might like to speak to our GP and have a solve that for me.
I'm actually going to talk about it in my talk, but very briefly, we are doing a project in Govan called the Governorship Project, which is a government-funded integration project, and I'll talk about that one of those issues and how we made joined up thinking much better and share information, all of that stuff, because we are actually now going to child protection discussions and meetings.
That's good to hear.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I think I will bring
the session to an end because everybody's looking slightly caffeine deprived. I'd like to thank Catherine very much for coming along here. She must sometimes feel like she's walking into the den of lions. It's been lovely having you here today. I've already written down two action points arising. We're going to look at how baby box uptake varies by socioeconomic status, and also we're going to ask schools why they're giving our kids puddings. Richard, did you have any last comments?
I'll just make a comment about the food. I mean, there is good guidance out there, both for school food and now for hospital food. We were involved, Children's Health Scotland, in developing the new guidelines for children's food in hospital. But it brings me back to one of my points is that it's all very well having the good policies and thinking you're delivering, but unless you monitor what is happening, and you're right, we need to together to monitor what is happening as well as a formal monitoring, then it's very likely that children will go on suffering poor food both in hospital and at school, I'm afraid.
Okay. So you've got 15 minutes.
Ladies and